Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we're going to be happy that it's 2014, and we'll be talking in a great conversation with Libby Hart, RN, nurse educator for UNC Hospice, about hospice care, comfort, and compassion.
Well, Christy, this time of year after Christmas and New Year, it's a tough time for a lot of people, patients, doctors, really everyone. It's very joyous, but also there's a lot of people particularly who've experienced loss at this time of year, and this is a really hard time, so I'm looking forward to this conversation, but also do say Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you as well. And we have some good research that matters today. We're going to talk about insomnia or sleep problems maybe being linked with time of death with men.
About if you do have to undergo surgery this time of year or any time of year, how do you know that your surgeon is the best, or what does that really even mean?
And knee or hip replacements might cut risk for heart disease or heart attacks.
And finally, a lot of people come to see a lot of doctors saying that they need testosterone. And how much is too much or too little?
Yeah, an interesting one. Okay, let's start out with insomnia. I don't know how many of you out there are like me, but sometimes it's hard to fall asleep or to stay asleep. And this is a really common problem for a lot of people.
And this particular research, which was published in the journal Circulation, was researchers from Brigham and Women's Hospital up in Boston looked at data from over 23,000 men who were part of a long-term study, and they didn't have cancer when they entered this study. And they also then looked at their long-time difficulties falling asleep, and they tracked these men between 2004 and 2010.
Over this six-year period, people who had trouble falling asleep, these men, that raised the risk of dying from heart-related reasons over those 6 years by 55%, compared with men who didn't have any insomnia symptoms. And having trouble staying asleep raised their risk of death by 32%. So definitely a link. This is an additional study showing some link between sleep and heart disease and death.
And it really doesn't matter what type, you know, why people have insomnia, or, you know, if it's medical versus psychological. The fact is that there may be some linkage between the amount of sleep, if you're not getting enough of it, and the development of factors that are leading to increased risk of heart disease and death. And so, you know, this, we're going to do a whole show, I think, on sleep-related issues, because we think that this is one of the next revolutions in medicine, that not just we're going to have better drugs, but we're going to have better things that we can do to help people get better sleep.
Yeah, it may be worth, just as a teaser, going ahead and having our health sciences librarians put up a few common tips of things you can do, not medications, but just common things you can do that will help your likelihood of falling asleep.
That's a very good
thing. Let's go ahead and do
that. Let's not do it today while we're doing our show, but on the show, we'll definitely talk about
this. We'll put that on our blog.
Speaking of things that we need to talk about, this next research that matters, I think we're stepping into a frying pan, but it's an important pan to be in. And this is research about your surgeon when you have to have surgery, and the skill of the surgeon, does it matter in terms of your outcomes? And a question that maybe many of us have thought about, but I've not seen research on this before, and I think it's important research.
This is very important research. This was published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine. The relationship between a surgeon's technique in the operating room and patient outcomes. So this is one of those things that, you know, how do you know if you're going to get surgery, how good, you know, how nice the surgeon is and how smart he sounds and whether he talks to you and explains things to you. But you don't necessarily know how good his fingers are and how gentle he is when he cuts into things. They're female surgeons.
Absolutely. And moreover, a lot of patients tell me, well, I don't really care how nice my surgeon is. I just want to know, do they have really good hands here? And this particular research, like you said, Christy, in the New England Journal of Medicine, they recruited 20 surgeons, and they videotaped their operations. And then they came up with an expert panel of surgeons to rank the quality of the surgeons' hands as they were watching the operation. Like you said, how gentle did they cut? How long did they do the surgery? How many instruments they used in exposing and cleaning and closing, all the things that are important to a good outcome. And they found tremendous variation even among these 20 surgeons in all of these characteristics.
Yeah, I think the researchers and the experts who are watching this were surprised that there was such a big difference. And then the surgeons who were in the bottom quartile, who were deemed by the experts to not be as good, they took 40% more time to complete the same operation, and they actually had higher mortality rates than the ones who were ranked at the top. So that means their outcomes, like more of their patients died than the people who were, you know, more deft and more sort of good with their hands in the operating room.
And it was not just about necessarily the things related to the surgery, like infections, but about post-operative care, pneumonia, blood clots, which could reflect a particular treating doctor's attendance to all of the things that matter. But we should also say, I think that this research, while really important, it's not just the doctor and the surgeon that makes a difference in surgery. It's the entire team that's also caring for you. And that may be equally, if not more important. We don't really know that.
Well, I think this is the beginning of us understanding what those factors are and really being able to train our surgeons in a way and upskill the ones who need help. We're talking about people's lives. It really makes a difference.
We get judged, Christy, frequently on things of how well we control our listeners' blood pressures and their diabetes and whether we can get them to successfully quit smoking. So I think increasingly you will see literature to say how well does a surgeon's outcomes. And this is important data because you would like to know you're getting treated by a competent and a good family doctor and a competent and good surgeon. And we should say that the great majority, this does not mean that those had higher complication rates weren't competent.
That's right. So, sometimes the best surgeons take more complicated cases, and so their outcomes might look a little worse, but
not a specialist for 100 miles and you have to treat the patient that's there in front of you. So this is the beginning of a conversation.
It sure is. Okay, let's talk about knee and hip replacements and heart risks.
So this was a study that really looked at those who had 150 people with severe or moderate arthritis who had a knee or hip replacement and compared them to a similar number of people who did not, and then really looked at over 7 years how frequently they had heart events, and did the surgery actually lead to less people having heart events?
And this research was posted online in BMJ, the medical journal, and the results for that compared with the people who didn't have any knee or hip surgery, the people who did have a knee or hip replacement operation were 40% less likely to have a cardiovascular event. So that's like a heart attack or a stroke. So there was a real difference and a real reduction in a risk of those things if you did have the surgery.
Right. Though we should say this isn't cause and effect. So we're not saying you should rush out to have surgery just to cut your cardiovascular risk. But we are saying that maybe there is something to this idea that if you are eligible for a joint replacement,
well, then you move more.
You move more.
I mean, you might think that those people would have worse outcomes from complications from surgery, but I wonder if it's just that they're able to move more and work their heart a little more, and maybe that's what makes a difference. Certainly more research needs to be done, but I think it shows some promise.
The last research that matters, Christy, is a really interesting research that was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism about testosterone and longevity, or the length of time you live. If you're a man, does it matter if you have low testosterone, medium testosterone with normal range, or high testosterone?
And Adam was super excited that we're talking about a man's topic. No, we're not talking about women right now. We're talking about men and their testosterone.
Well, we have so many patients that come to us, Christy and I, and all of my colleagues, really wanting supplements. Men in their 50s, 60s, 70s taking testosterone supplements are asking about it because they hear on the TV and the radio and the news all the time about testosterone supplements lead to longer life. The answer of this research study is absolutely not.
Right. Okay, so This was looking at older men whose testosterone levels were not low or high, but just normal. And they found that for people who had sort of middle-range testosterone, did survive longer than their counterparts who had either super low testosterone or super high testosterone. It didn't necessarily tell us the chicken or the egg. It just said that people who had normal testosterone levels lived longer.
Right. And so that does imply, I think, one thing that I will educate my patients who are taking testosterone supplements is if you have a low testosterone, it may be indicated for you. But if it's normal, it may not be indicated for you.
Right, could be harmful.
It may be harmful.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Adam and I will be talking with Libby Hart, RN nurse educator for UNC Hospice, about hospice care, comfort, and compassion. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Libby Hart, RN and nurse educator for University of North Carolina Hospice, about hospice care, comfort, and compassion. Welcome to Your Health, Libby.
Thank you.
Libby, you have a rich amount of experience with hospice, but I wonder if you would tell us and our listeners a little bit about how hospice became the focus of your career and your form of compassion to patients.
Thanks. Yes. Many years ago, about 18 to be exact, actually even longer before that, my mother was a hospice volunteer. Our hospice agency started out as Chatham Hospice, and my mother was one of the very first volunteers. So throughout my childhood and when I was going through nursing school, I would hear her stories about hospice care and the volunteer work that she did with hospice. And so I became a nurse and worked in a hospital so I could get a good, strong clinical background, because you need that when you're doing home care. And we moved back into the area, and a position came open. And I always like to give my mom credit for getting me my job, as she did. She called the director and said, "You need to hire my daughter." Aww. So I've been there for 18 years doing hospice nursing. And I credit my mother and her volunteerism and her passion for hospice.
Well, I got some other things she could do for me, some people she may want to call
and
make some
sweet
changes.
Story.
No. But I wonder if we could just take a step of saying, what is hospice? Christy and I, as we were preparing for the show, I said, "Christy, what's that word actually mean?" And so when we say hospice care, we're all on the same page, because I bet a lot of patients maybe don't know, or even a lot of doctors may have misconceptions of what it means.
Sure. Hospice care is a group approach to caring for, or a team approach to caring for, terminally ill patients and their family. One thing that distinguishes us from other healthcare agencies or places is that hospice cares for the patient and the family as one unit of care. And we do this with a team approach.
And so, speaking of misconceptions, Adam, I have the experience, you know, in my clinical care and caring for families, sometimes if you bring up the word hospice, people think, oh, you're just writing me off as dying, or that just means that we're accepting death. But I know from personal experience, when my father was dying, that hospice, coming into the home and offering resources, was such a gift to my family at that time. And I wonder how you frame it to people and how you overcome some of the misconceptions about hospice.
Sure. If I can get one point across, is that hospice is hope. Hope changes throughout our lives. When we're younger, we might hope for a bicycle for Christmas. When we're older, we might hope to get a job or get married. When you're terminally ill, your hope changes, and you may hope when you are very ill that you have a day without pain or a day without nausea, or you may hope that the people that are taking care of you will be supported. And that's what hospice offers, is hope. Hope that my symptoms will be managed to the best of their ability, or the best they can be. It's hope that my family will know what to do in my dying phase. So hospice is hope.
What, I mean, when you're saying this hope, it sounds almost so easy, but it's mm-hmm. not easy. Can you think of any recent experience or the types of things that come up with folks who, first off, you get a call, people wondering, is hospice right for my family? Who calls you?
Sure. So we get calls from a lot of people. We get calls from the discharge planners at the hospital, or maybe the doctor's office, or sometimes it's a family member or friend. And when you've had a long-term illness, which a lot of these folks that were going into their home, they have been battling their illness for a long, long time, you begin to struggle and trying to figure out where are the resources. So a lot of people are afraid of the hospice word. But once we get into people's homes and we tell them all of the services that we do.
Like,
we have nurses on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, not meaning that we're in your home 24/7, but available. Hospice, our goal is really the patient and the family's goals. And once we find out the patient and the family's goal is to stay at home and to stay comfortable, then to know that they could call a nurse 24 hours a day, 7 days a week is very helpful and hopeful to them. Then they're not having to call 911 or go back to the emergency room. And we're there for maybe a simple question in the middle of the night, or maybe they're afraid because their loved one has made a change and they want someone to come out and see that and do an assessment and tell them what changes have been made and what to expect. So that's one of our services. We have several other team members. Would you like to hear about them?
Sure. Tell us more.
Great. So our nurses are case managers, and their primary goal is to manage the patient's symptoms, and they work with the primary doctor. A lot of people have a misconception that when you sign up to hospice, you get rid of your doctor. We do not get rid of your doctor. You keep the same doctor that you have, and the nurse and the hospice teams work with that primary doctor to provide you the best care that can be provided. We also have nursing assistants who do personal care, bathing and dressing and showering, all the things that need to happen every day that sometimes families get really burned out of doing, or sometimes just aren't comfortable doing those things. We have social workers, and they focus on non-medical issues, things like funeral planning, long-term care policies, other things that maybe they need financial resource help.
And so when is it appropriate for families to start looking into hospice, and what criteria do patients need to sort of meet in order to be eligible for these services?
Right, because most people would like
it. Right, I know. I'm like, that would help a lot of my patients.
Well, that is true. A lot of times people like to put off hospice to the end because they're afraid. But once we get our foot in the door and we tell them all the services that we provide, then they're always thinking, oh, I wish I had done that sooner.
Exactly.
Why didn't I do that sooner? So what criteria? You have to have a doctor who will certify that you have 6 months or less to live. That is the biggest criteria. That's the first thing.
Mm. And just to chime in on that, I think a lot of doctors maybe are afraid to say that because we aren't the best predictors of how long people have to live. And so part of our real teaching in family medicine and primary care is focused on, you know, it's okay to make your best guess, and as long as that's a reasonable guess, then that's okay.
That certainly happens. That certainly happens frequently. We'll get a phone call from a physician, and maybe let's say they don't have a cancer diagnosis. Maybe they have congestive heart failure or COPD, and they feel like their patient is ready for hospice. And we go out and do an assessment, and we realize the functional status of the patient is actually pretty good by hospice standards. So we have Medicare sets for us standards for each illness and criteria that they have to meet.
So you can help guide the doctors.
We can definitely.
On that too.
Yes, we can.
Well, we do need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Libby Hart, RN and nurse educator, for UNC Hospice to talk about hospice care, comfort, and compassion. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Libby Hart, RN, nurse educator for UNC Hospice, about hospice care, comfort, and compassion. And before the break, earlier in our conversation, Libby, you spoke about the team approach to care and about caring for the patient, but also caring for the family as a unit. And I know that I've certainly had encounters where sometimes families at the end of a loved one's life have disagreements in what should be done, how much should be done, all kinds of family dynamics that can come up in those late stages. How do you approach that as a team to care for some of those dynamics? I'm sure you've seen them.
Sure. So our approach is always the patient's goals and what they're wanting, and the family's goals and what they're wanting. And a lot of times it is two different things. For example, people at the end of their life usually don't like to eat. And we as caregivers love to feed people. We love to feed people.
Makes us feel like we're doing something.
It makes us feel like we're doing something.
Have you been in my house recently?
It is a care thing that we do. So when you have a terminal illness and nothing else can be done, one thing that family members can do is feed people. And it makes them feel good. They'll say, well, they ate all their lunch or they ate all their dinner. Well, one thing I do as a hospice nurse is I talk about what can we expect in this disease process? What can we expect in the dying process? And one is lack of appetite. And usually when I bring that up, I usually get the patient to almost sit up and really pay attention, because lack of appetite is something they had been experiencing for months. But to make their caregivers happy, they eat. So I had this one patient one time, and I said to her, this is about you, and you can choose to eat and drink what you want to eat and drink. And if you don't want to eat or drink anything, that's okay, because this is your body and this is what's happening to you. I also explained to the family that really sometimes eating and drinking makes people feel lousy. Well, we had the two conversations at two different times. I gave the patient permission not to eat or drink. And that night after I left at dinner time, she promptly announced to her family that she could eat or drink whatever she wanted to, because Libby Hart, hospice nurse, told her so. And the caregivers didn't think much or didn't say much to her about it. But boy, the next day I got a phone call and said, who gives you permission to tell my mother what she cannot and can and cannot eat? So I then once again further explained to this caregiver what it must feel like to not, she had a breathing problem, to have to eat a meal and feel like you're catching your breath the whole time, how much energy it takes to eat. And when I explained it that way, it was much better. But it does. It happens with food and eating. It happens with antibiotics. And what we do as a group, we try to have the two come together and approach it.
You know, if we think about your definition at some level, when we talked about this comfort and compassion and mm-hmm. hope, as you so nicely mm-hmm. phrased it, but it's in the last 6 months of one's mm-hmm. life, presumably at a time in which one is dying. I see this as a provider, sometimes the conflict that comes up around pain management mm-hmm. and the family members fear that their loved one is getting too much pain medication mm-hmm. and therefore is not able to communicate. How do you navigate that in complexity and also reassure both the family member and the patient that you're not, well, killing the patient by giving them too much pain medication?
Sure. That issue comes up a lot. Fear of pain medication, fear of morphine. We use a liquid morphine that's highly concentrated, and it takes just a tiny bit in order to relieve the pain. So first of all, once you're going to do a good assessment, what is the patient's goals? And maybe one of their goals is, I don't want to take medications. I want to stay as coherent as I can. And that, we're going to respect that and try to educate them on the side effects of pain medication and how those side effects can disappear after they've taken them for a few days, and try to do our best on educating the side effects and what about the medications. Then we will, if the patient's desire is to be as comfortable as they can be and they don't care how sleepy they're going to be, then it's just talking it through. And we're never going to give too many medicines to make somebody sleepy. You know, it's not our goal to end somebody's life sooner. Our goal is to manage the symptoms to the best of our abilities. And a lot of it is education, education. A lot of my visits, I won't necessarily listen to a heart rate or take a blood pressure or do all those nurse-type things that a lot of people think you do on a visit, but it might just be listening and talking and explaining.
Well, I know you provide chaplain services as part of hospice, and you talk about hope. I'm sure as people are facing the end of their lives, you know, their faith or their thoughts about what happens when they die and their thoughts about their life, I'm sure that that brings up a lot of different family dynamics as well as personal journey about their faith. How do you incorporate faith and hope and dying into your care?
When we do an assessment and then every visit thereafter, we're constantly looking on how well is the patient coping, how well is the family coping, and what are there other supportive systems in place. And our chaplains will go out. They either are a chaplain or they may be providing some grief counseling or spiritual support. And they're going to base it on what that patient and family already have in place to augment it. Or if they have nothing in place, they will come in and do a visit. And once again, it's in the home setting. So you're really seeing people at their face value. And they're usually very open and honest about their experiences and what they need.
So let's talk the nuts and bolts. I have no money. I'm uninsured. I'm 72 years old, and I've got a fatal diagnosis, and I want hospice. Can I get it? What's it going to cost me? What's it going to cost my family?
Sure. UNC Hospice does take care of people who are uninsured or that are indigent. Our social workers will do a sliding scale, see what the income is that's coming in, and we come up with a base rate, a daily rate. But I will say that most of the time, if you're uninsured and you don't have any money, you're not going to be able to make that daily rate. So we just, the families do the best that they possibly can, but we have not denied care.
And if you've got Medicare?
If you have Medicare, then you're covered with the under the hospice Medicare benefit. And we get a per diem a day every day that we have a patient on service.
You mentioned earlier about your mom being a volunteer for hospice. So there are people who are employed by hospice, like yourself, to be a nurse and this team that you described. But then you've also have volunteers. Tell us the role of the volunteers and maybe how our listeners, if they wanted to be a part of hospice, could do that.
Sure. We have volunteers who are people in our community that want to help hospice in some capacity. So they all go through a volunteer training. And our volunteer training is usually held 2 times a year. And it varies in the length of hours in the week. Sometimes it lasts longer in week's duration, but it's a shorter hour. So anyway, our volunteers are trained, and they're trained in everything about hospice. So they know what our agency is all about, what the hospice Medicare benefit is all about. Usually during that training, they have an opportunity to think about what it is that they want to do. Sometimes they come in with one idea and go out with another. So some examples of what our volunteers do. We had a volunteer this past spring come up with a program to get bring flowers out to our patients. So she goes to florists and other places that have leftover flowers, makes bouquets, and our volunteers deliver flowers.
Wow, how sweet.
Yeah. Our volunteers also provide respite, or they may run errands.
So when you say respite, tell us what that means.
Respite. Most of our patients are very ill, and they cannot be left home alone. So our volunteers can provide several hours at a time so the family members can go out and run errands or maybe go out to dinner or do something for themselves. The volunteers will be there with the patient.
We've been talking with Libby Hart, RN, nurse educator for UNC Hospice, about hospice care, comfort, and compassion. And Libby, we really want to thank you for being a guest with us on Your Health Today. I think in addition to the comfort and compassion, which really exudes from you to our listeners, I think the hope And I love this idea of the goals in the last 6 months in life are no less important than the goals at other points in times in our life. And that's a take-home message that I'll take with me. And thank you for sharing with us, for all our listeners today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Libby.
We're going to take a short break. But coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you want us to address any health question or concern on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we've got some interesting house calls today about inhalers and spacers, and not the type of space, but outer space, but for asthma.
About hearing the doctor tell you you're pre-diabetic.
About what happens when you have a heart attack, and should you be cooled? Should your body temperature be cooled? Would that make a difference in your ability to survive?
About getting a virus and getting antibiotics.
Lots of really interesting questions. Let's ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first house call today.
I'm 42 years old and have asthma and use an albuterol inhaler. When I went to talk with my doctor, they recommended a spacer, which is an additional $15. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, boy, that's a really good question, and one that I think a lot of times we as providers, Christy, don't give enough attention to, and I'm really glad to hear that the pharmacist raised this issue.
Sure, and, you know, we recommend this often for children who you're trying to give the inhaler, and a spacer really helps the medicine go into that tube that's attached to the inhaler and then actually get delivered into the lungs when the child breathes. And so in this case, it sounds like your doctor or your pharmacist has recommended this to you as an adult, which I wondered if someone was doing some teaching with you and sort of seeing that maybe you're having trouble getting the hang of the proper way to take your inhaler.
Yeah, too often people take that inhaler and they stick it in their mouth, and our pharmacists are quick to tell us as doctors that that medicine goes and sticks to the back of your throat a lot of times and doesn't get as much down into your lungs. So even though it may be $15, insurance should cover it if you have insurance, in addition to which you may actually have a more efficient use of your inhaler, and ultimately that could be cost-effective for you, and more important, it could be life-saving for you because you're getting more of the medicine that's prescribed, particularly in asthma care. So it actually, for a lot of people, is really easier to use than without it. So I would say there's no harm in this. It's a good thing for you.
Yeah, especially if you can get it covered, then it's certainly worth a try and may actually improve your asthma care. Let's take our very next house call question.
I went to the doctor last week and was told I was pre-diabetic. Once I heard those words, I pretty much zoned out and couldn't tell you what information I was given. I left the doctor's office scared to death, picturing myself wearing an insulin pump and missing extremities. By the way, my grandfather was a bad diabetic and had to undergo multiple amputations. If I eat right and exercise, will it go away?
Oh, I'm sorry that this frightened you. I think, you know, just hearing the words diabetes and having those experiences as a child definitely can be sort of jarring and scary. And so we appreciate you sharing those feelings that you had. I think sometimes as doctors, we don't realize the impact of those words.
All right. We might say, you're just a little bit diabetic. You know, like somehow we're trying to not scare you just a little bit there. And on the other hand, you know, I think from a doctor's perspective, we probably do want to not scare you, but I think we want to get your attention. I don't think it was effective in this particular circumstance, and we could have done it a different way by saying, we don't want you to be scared, but we do want to get your attention, and let's just be honest and have an honest conversation.
And so you ask about your diet and exercise, and definitely working on your diet and exercise for weight loss specifically, weight loss can get that number out of the pre-diabetes range and really ward that off. So I would take this really as a wake-up call to look at your weight, and if you are overweight, to really work on that as a major priority in your life.
Yeah, I think it's a blessing, and because you can change before you become diabetic. Now, mm-hmm. I would perhaps have that conversation with your doctor and say, you know, last time I was there, I just kind of zoned out.
Uh-huh.
You may have told me about all these things, and you guys can laugh a little bit. But also, your doctor should get a little feedback here. Help them understand that for some people, and for you in particular, you needed just a little bit more time or maybe a little more follow-up, and that's helpful.
And also, having your doctor know that you had this scary experience from your grandfather may really help guide that doctor in how to counsel you over time.
Great point, Christy. What's our very next house call, Erica?
My husband's father had a heart attack last year and was unresponsive when he reached the hospital. They placed cooling packs on him to prevent further brain damage for 24 hours. Doctors later informed us that he was in a vegetative state and he died 2 weeks later. Since then, I've wondered if the cooling process was beneficial. Do these cooling packs really work?
You know, I am so sorry. This is such a hard issue. And here you were wondering and going and struggling for a long period of time with a very traumatic event. So we certainly understand that, and we're so sorry about that.
And, you know, the cooling protocols are used in a lot of different settings, and some of them have success. They're used a lot of times with little babies in the neonatal ICU and can really help babies survive. And so there are cases where it can work. There's a little bit of research about this.
Yeah, in the Journal of the American Medical Association recently, there was a large study where they actually really tested this hypothesis that these reducing the temperature of people in this type of setting might improve survival, might limit that lactic acid, might limit that cardiac damage. And unfortunately, it did not show a difference. It was not shown with any improvement with people in their full recovery or those having mild impairments. So it's not something that is probably going to be done for many patients in this circumstance mm-hmm. moving forward. And the best strategy is, of course, preventing death, having an automatic defibrillator right there when people have sudden heart attacks, and getting people into the hospital quickly.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you for sharing your story, and our heart goes out to you. Erica, give us our very last house call question.
I work in a small office and am in close proximity to everyone. There was recently a virus that seemed to take out half of the staff. Some employees came back to work with symptoms, but claimed they were on antibiotics. I'm worried because I have a six-month-old at home. How long is someone contagious after beginning antibiotics, and does it depend on the type of sickness?
That's a potent question.
I know there's so much in there.
That virus actually came into your question, which is a good question, but there's a lot there. Like, what are you thinking about, Christy?
Well, the first thing I'm thinking, there's so many things to say, but is that there are a lot of viruses that go around. But if you have a virus, an antibiotic actually doesn't help it, because antibiotics fight against bacteria, and viruses are a different kind of organism. So, people with viruses normally shouldn't get antibiotics or need antibiotics in that setting. So it's kind of a loaded and confusing question of what's going on in the office.
Yeah, my first thought was, I'm so glad you didn't get those antibiotics because you didn't run the risk of developing resistance and mm-hmm. passing that resistance on, or having one of these antibiotic-associated complications or
yep.
things that might pass on again to your children. So you did the right thing and you're asking the right question. What I would say is, we hope you're washing your hands
a lot. That's exactly the second thing that came to mind. Wash your hands, flu shot, and don't smoke. All of these things, washing your hands, avoiding smoking or quitting now, getting your flu shot. These are the best ways.
And if you've not had it, getting your vaccination for diphtheria, your adult booster against
uh-huh.
diphtheria, which comes in a common form. So great question, and thank you, everyone, for all your questions today. And we want to hope that we've answered questions that are important to you and your health.
We want you to share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and get our health app.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Libby Hart. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.